Lengthening hours, lessening pay, no parental leave, scant job security. Never have so many workers needed so much support. Yet the very labor unions that could garner protections and help workers speak up for themselves are growing weaker every day. At an age of rampant inequality, of increasing social protests and strikes, and when a majority of workers say they want to be union members, why does the union density continue to decline? Sean Richman offers some answers in his new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Sean Richman has spent a decade and a half as a union organizer and representative, and we welcome him to the roundtable this morning. Sean, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what brought you to this particular subject?
I spent about 15 years on active duty as a union organizer, organizing director, as a negotiator. And, I was at the point where I was in charge of spending $4 million a year to organize 1,000 workers. And so it just became clear to me that the system was just totally broken. I needed to step away from it and think about and write about all the ways that it's broken and the ways that it can and needs to be fixed.
Okay, so how is it broken? Give us a sense of where you find the problems.
So the problems are that the National Labor Relations Board is an efficient union-busting operation when you have a Republican president. It is a not effective organization that has been tied up in knots by a decades of bad Supreme Court decisions during a Democratic administration. But bigger than that, basing whether you have a union or not on the specific workplace and your specific employer and whether there was a high-stakes election there sometime in the past and somehow you've held on to the contract is broken. And employers have spent 50 years seceding from that system. They secede from that system by subcontracting operations, by offshoring operations, by gigifying and turning into freelancers all their workers. All of that is meant to relieve the true decision makers, the real bosses, from any obligation for respecting the rights, the pay, the benefits of their actual employees through these sort of legal fictions of these subcontractors. And so what we need are all-in systems of labor relations. I think we need a just cause, right to your job law. I think we need systems of workplace government in each workplace. That could be look like works councils, like on the German model. It could look like industrial labor boards that would set terms and conditions of employment across all employers within specific industries. But there should be stuff that happens on day one. There's no need to opt into, and there's no way for the employers to opt out of it. And within those systems, it would be it would be up to workers to decide if they want to join a union and which union they want to join. But there's going to be a workplace government. There's going to be forms of representation, and there's going to be protections in place.
So it has been pointed out that there are estimates that suggest about 60% of American workers want union representation. Meanwhile, 11% haven't. So how do we explain that disparity?
We explain that disparity by the way that the law smiles on an employer who breaks the law with impunity. We could talk about how union elections happen, an NLRB certification election, which is where workers would decide whether they want to have a union or not, very high-stakes election. And the rules of the election are such, this is an arm of the federal government deciding if there's going to be an election, running this election. The rules are such that one party and one party only can force every voter into a mandatory presentation of their position. And in this mandatory, you could be fired if you don't go. And in this presentation, they can threaten your job, they can lie, they can hire somebody to impersonate a federal agent to lie to you about what your rights even are. And crucially, it's not just that the one party is a boss, it's that it's only a boss that advocates a no vote. If a boss says, well, actually, a union would be a good idea, that would somehow also be illegal. One of the things I'm saying is when you step back from it, and you look at it in those terms, how is this not a massive violation of workers' First Amendment rights? But beyond that, I mean, the problems aren't just limited to the elections that happen, because, you know, you win the election. Okay, great. I won plenty of NLRB elections. You get to the bargaining table, and the first thing they do on day one is they put your health insurance on the bargaining table, and they start saying, well, you know, we've been too generous. We're gonna need you to pay more of your premiums. Here you are. You're trying to make gains. Workers formed a union because they want wage increases, and the boss is retaliating by saying, you know, now we're going to bargain over your health insurance. And by the way, they threatened that through the entire campaign very effectively. Now they're actually carrying it out. I'll also say anecdotally, in about three-quarters of the campaigns that I ran where we got to the bargaining table, management would inevitably subcontract some part of the workers out of the bargaining unit. It's just a great way to throw a bomb into negotiations. Oh, the janitors, we're gonna hire a janitorial cleaning firm, and so all the janitors now no longer work for us. So it's very difficult to form a union. Plus, again, you know, the law smiles on an employer that wants to get out of their union obligations. Very easy to just ship the jobs overseas. Very easy to just subcontract out huge swaths of your workforce, and very easy to demand draconian concessions in a bargaining agreement. And the blueprint here is, you know, bargain your workers to impasse over you know, major cuts in pay, in benefits. Dare them out on strike, hire a bunch of scabs, and then, you know, let 12 months go by and the scabs can decertify the union.
So zooming in on what you just said a moment ago and dovetailing on my question, which is why there was that disparity. So you have many people who have this lack of job security, and that has them form an interest in a union. And then they are concerned that they will lose their job if they take steps to join a union. So how do you get over that? How do you get over that problem of you're damned if you do and damned if you don't?
Well, one of the reasons I advocate for a just cause right to your job law is, we should have it. It's a sort of a standard right across the Western world, across the industrialized world, and more than that. I mean, it's a standard right in across Africa and China. And what a just cause law does is it means that you can't be fired for just any old reason. You can't be fired for a bad reason. You have to be fired for a good work performance-based reason that you were given, you know, advance notice about. Now, this is very commonly negotiated in union contracts. And one of the reasons that we don't have a just cause law in America is that I think too many people in the labor movement think that's what you get with a union, so form a union. But it's what's holding us back, because the fear is tremendous, and employers are terminating now with impunity. So workers know that their jobs are at risk if they organize. So I think changing the law would help. That said, I think workers are getting braver. I think, you know, you can only push us, you know, push our backs against the wall so far before we've got nothing left to lose, you know. And so right, we're seeing a tremendous increase in strike activity, you know, and part of this is, you know, it helps that the fast food, the Fight for 15 campaign started doing these rolling one-day strikes. And, I mean, that's a job where, you know, what are you going to do, fire me from McDonald's? Like, Wendy's is going to be so much better or so much worse? You know, so you're seeing a lot of fight back, and that's important because ultimately our power comes from the work that we do and our occasional refusal to do it. But the problem of strikes are contagious, right?
Right.
But workers have to see other workers go on strike and win in order to start thinking about their own, you know, where their own power is based.
So let me ask you about strikes. Growing up in the 1980s, I saw strikes all the time when I was growing up and outside of Philadelphia. In fact, hell, my school went on strike. The teachers went on strike, I think, three times when I was in elementary school. You don't see strikes like that anymore.
Right. Well, strikes are contagious, and it could go in both directions. And so what happened in the 1980s is that process that I described of, you know, hard bargaining your union on concessions, pushing them out on strike, and then permanently replacing the workers, that started at a copper mining company called Phelps Dodge in, I would say, 1982. And then that was the blueprint. Once they successfully did it, hundreds of corporations did it, and so workers saw strikes as something that you could lose, and lose a lot in. You lose your job, you lose your pension, you lose everything, and so workers became afraid of strikes, and we hit a real low point in strikes not that long ago, about a decade ago, I think was the absolute bottom. I think that's changed. I think the market's a bit tighter. Conditions are so bad that people are willing to fight back a bit more. And you know, you saw, first of all, you see the fight for 15 strikes. I think that put a sort of electric charge in the air. I think the Chicago teachers strike of 2012 was really important because they won. And then it got more teachers thinking about striking. We saw a whole wave of Red for Ed teacher strikes in 2018 and 2019. And now that's putting these thoughts in the air. I think that we may potentially be in a strike wave right now. It's very hard to tell because, you know, all the journalists are getting laid off. And
right.
All the government workers are working from home, so nobody's keeping statistics on it. But there's all these wildcat strikes that are happening over personal protective gear, over safety protocols, you know, at Amazon fulfillment centers, at McDonald's stores, I can't wait till we all get back to work so we can just turn around and immediately go on strike. I hope we're learning some lessons from this moment.
Well, let's talk about this moment because, I mean, you write about this, that because of this massive inequality and the poverty that we have in this country, you believe that gives us opportunities. There are great possibilities here.
Yes. I mean, there's the left tends to tell ourselves, I think, some disempowering narratives about how change happens. And so there's this notion in the labor movement of we're not going to get labor law reform until, you know, we get the general strike. So let's focus on getting the general strike. Let's figure out how to get back to the sit-down strikes, and then we could talk about the law. First of all, if you actually are successful and you spark the crisis, somebody else is going to write the laws. So maybe we should be thinking about the law, how we want the laws to change now, while we're also trying to figure out how to bring the strike back. We can walk and chew bubble gum at the same time. But beyond that, the lesson from, say, 1932, right, because that's maybe the best analogy for the year 2020, you know, huge crisis, huge economic crisis going on, hopefully major change when the elections come, and unions are at an all-time weak moment. But the crisis is our crisis of democracy. It's our crisis of rampant inequality. And even before COVID, I think you had a lot of Democratic policy people who had this sort of "oh crap" moment that they realized, well, Trump won because we let them kill the unions, and that in order to win office and hold office, that they have to do serious things right away to restore the power of workers, so that workers can redistribute some of the wealth in this country, and we can sort of get out of that crisis. And that's the reality. So the crisis already exists, and that's what makes some change possible. Now, it might not be enough, and I point to 1932. Roosevelt's whole first approach to the Great Depression was not pro-labor, it was pro-corporate. But he threw something into his first big bill, the one that created the National Recovery Administration. He said, Section 7A, the federal government's going to guarantee your right to organize. Wasn't worth the paper it was written on. There was no enforcement mechanism, and bosses were literally shooting workers who went on strike. But it was just enough to raise the expectations of workers and then quickly dash their hopes that it is, I think, directly responsible for a strike wave that occurred in 1934 that created the real crisis that got us the National Labor Relations Act. So there's sort of a dialectic at play here is what I'm suggesting. And that's what my book is trying to speak to. It's speaking to both the legal reforms that are necessary to get us thinking about them now, but also speaking to sort of an audience of activists of, well, how do we ruin the boss's day today?
Right.
Because that's a part of how you get the change.
You touched on the election a moment ago, and my final question to you is, what should our hopes be? What should our expectations be? What is realistic in thinking if there is a new administration in the fall?
If there's a new administration in the fall, I think we'll get something. And it won't be enough, but it might be enough, just along the same lines of raising expectations and then dashing hopes. I do think that regardless of what happens, we need more protest and we need more strikes, and we're going to need to put some real pressure on the government and on corporate America to put some fear into them, regardless of who wins.
Sean Richman is the author of the new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. The book is published by Monthly Review Press. Sean, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.